Acts 27 to 28, 16. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends to be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we'd sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra and Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city Lasea. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. And because the harbour was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there, on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbour of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind, called the Northeaster, struck down from the land, and when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. After hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear and thus were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo, and on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me, and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong, an angel of the God to whom I belong and to whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul, for you must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you.' So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I've been told, but we must run aground on some island." When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes from the ship's boat and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you've continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. We were in all 276 persons on the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach, on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudders. Then, hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldier's plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. After we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled the fire and welcomed us all, because it had begun to rain and was cold. When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. When the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Now in the neighbourhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island, named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery, and Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. They also honoured us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. After 3 months, we set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria, with the twin gods as a figurehead. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed for 3 days. And from there we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after 1 day a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came to Puteoli. There we found brothers and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and so we came to Rome. And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as the Forum of Appius and 3 taverns to meet us. On seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. And when we came into Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier that guarded him.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Phil, for the big read. I won't be talking about snakes and vipers. What do you do when you're at your wit's end? Where do you look when life is falling apart? Because we all face crises and fears at some stage in life, don't we? Whether you'd call yourself a Christian or an atheist or anything else, can't expect to go through life untouched and immune from the chaos of the world around us. How do you cope when fear stalks? Consider Paul. In our passage today, Luke's classic eyewitness account of stormy seas and shipwreck. Paul's a prisoner. He's been tried several times, consistently found innocent. His Christian faith has been found not troublemaking, not against Roman law, nor against Caesar, nor against the Jewish scriptures, nor against the Jewish people. And yet Paul's been violently cancelled. Received death threats with real intent from people with real political power. All because Paul preaches the resurrection of the dead, that we can be saved through Jesus Christ. So in the end, Paul has exercised his right of appeal as a Roman citizen to be tried before the emperor himself in Rome. And so Paul is sent to Rome, and we join him in Caesarea, And we're going to have a map to help us. You should have a small map. If not, there are plenty around on the seats in case you can't see this very clearly. But I think it would help us to follow it. He set sail from Caesarea under the authority and custody of Roman centurion Julius. Julius commandeers a ship of Adramyttium. Adramyttium's up there. So this is a coastal ship. It'll work the coast. And it will take advantage of the sea currents that run from east to west here along the coast of what we now call Turkey. So they go east of Cyprus and north of Cyprus, and here they have the advantage also of not being threatened by the prevailing west wind. They arrive at Myra, and here Julius will expect to find a grain ship bound for Rome. The grain trade, shipping grain from Egypt to Rome, is so important for the Roman Empire that the empire has a whole state department looking after it. The grain is needed in Rome to keep the population quiet and the politics stable. The Roman Empire affords special favours and protection to those shipping grain. And sure enough, Julius finds a grain ship at Myra. It's bound for Rome, and it's probably come from Alexandria up to Myra, and then it'll cross there round the toe of Italy towards Rome. So he uses his authority as a centurion. Julius secures passage for himself and Paul, his soldiers, and the other prisoners. And they battle along the coast to Cnidus. Ships at this time couldn't sail close to the wind, and so we read in verse 7 of our passage, "We arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, and as the wind did not allow us to go farther, we sailed under the lee of Crete, off Salmone." So there's Crete and there's the Cape of Salmone. So they come down here, out of the wind as far as they can. They struggle along the coast of Crete to fair havens. And here they decide to make a run for it, to Phoenix. It's only another 40 miles up the coast. And Paul makes his first intervention. "Don't try it." Paul has sailed a lot in the Mediterranean. He's experienced. He's already been shipwrecked 3 times. They all know that bad winter weather means the Med is effectively closed from November through to early February. Even sailing in October is dangerous, and we're well into October now. But as we read in verse 11, the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said. What does Paul know about shipping, they might have thought. Do we perceive the smell of money here? There's a bonus for getting the ship's grain to Rome before winter. Dunno. Anyway, deceived by a seductive south wind, perfect for cruising along the coast, they set off for Phoenix, and disaster strikes. A cyclonic northeast wind barrels down from Crete. This is still today the most treacherous and feared wind in the eastern Mediterranean. It's called the Grigal. And Phoenix is now out of the question. The ship has no chance. It's just blown south under the lee of a small island called Cauda there. Cauda affords a little protection from the wind, and they take the opportunity to get the lifeboat, which would have been towed behind the ship, get it onto the ship. And they probably do this so the lifeboat won't be catapulted forward by a wave into the back of a ship and hold it. "We managed with difficulty," says Luke in verse 16, probably remembering the blisters. But now they're in the open sea and they're in real trouble. They undergird the ship, running cables underneath the ship from side to side or from front to back to strengthen the ship against ferocious waves. Their fear is being blown southwest onto the dreaded quicksands of Cytis there, off the North African coast. So they lower the anchor, or maybe they drop the mainsail, it's not clear from the text, but they're trying to slow the ship down. And then in verse 18, as Phil read to us, they begin to jettison the cargo. Bang go the profits from the journey. They keep some of the grain for food, and probably as ballast in the stormy seas. But grain expands when it gets wet. It could split the planks of the ship, and that would be that. So most of the cargo goes overboard. And then they start chucking the ship's tackle. And this is really serious. Without control of the ship, their only hope now is to keep the ship light enough for long enough to run aground on some sand somewhere and avoid being stuck on rocks. Not much hope of that, really. And it's hard for us sitting here today to imagine the palpable sense of dread, disaster, even terror that now pervades the ship. The smell now is not the smell of money, but the smell of fear. And the tempest won't let them rest. Those who aren't seasick probably can't face food anyway, even if the relentless wind and waves would make it possible to prepare any food. Mountainous waves, almost as if they can sense that the ship's in trouble, moving greedily in for the kill. When neither sun nor stars appear for many days, we hear in verse 20, they lose any ability to reckon their position. Day after day, for 2 weeks, they have absolutely no idea where they are. They are lost. And that's why we've got this question mark here. Obviously, we don't know quite where they went, but they drifted across the open sea. All hope is lost. Way back in chapter 16, we saw Paul's jailer ask him, "What must I do to be saved?" Paul's whole life is about saving people through Jesus. Yet now the ship's company don't even ask what they can do to be saved. They've given up. All hope is abandoned. It's at this point in verse 21 that Paul makes his second intervention. He was right back in Crete. They should have listened to him and not set sail. But no use crying over spilt cargo. Take heart. And in verses 23 to 26, the turning point of this account, the heart of our passage today, Paul tells them why they should take heart. How these words of Paul must have gone in and resounded around Paul's listeners. "An angel of God to whom I belong and whom I worship said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island.'" And soon after, as they near land, Paul prevents the sailors from doing a bunk, persuades them all to have something to eat. They'll need strength for the shipwreck ahead. And we haven't got time to go through the rest of the account. Essentially, they run aground in Malta over 2 weeks and nearly 500 miles since they left Crete. Julius the centurion, a man of integrity, saves Paul's life by staying the soldiers' plan to kill their prisoners. The ship's lost, but not a hair of the men's head is lost. The people of Malta receive them kindly, and they spend the winter there. After 3 months, they continue pretty uneventfully on to Syracuse, to Rhegium, and then to Puteoli, the port that would have been used to get to Rome. And from there, the last leg is by road, and Christians from Rome, as we saw, come to meet them at the Forum of Appius and at the Three Taverns. And by the way, note this was quite an effort for the Christians in Rome. To hike 30 miles to Three Taverns, or another 10 miles to the Forum of Appius, to greet and side with a prisoner of the emperor. But what encouragement for Paul, to the extent that, as we read later in the passage in chapter 28, verse 15, Paul thanked God for them and took courage. Took courage before his looming final ordeal before Emperor Nero in Rome. It's in ways like that, isn't it, that we can support our Christian leaders today. So, Paul began as a prisoner, his position weak, his advice ignored. And yet, by the time they get to Italy, he's in virtual command of the ship. He is a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ, and as Paul's witness, honours the God to whom Paul belongs and whom Paul worships, so God in turn honours Paul. So what do we take away from this episode for our life in 21st century city of London? And our first point on the handout might seem a bit obvious, but we need to remind ourselves, don't we, not to expect plain sailing. It's on the back of the handout here where you've got it. Paul begins this voyage having already had it tough. He's already been stoned, beaten, flogged, imprisoned, endlessly persecuted by powerful enemies. Might we not expect God to cut him some slack? Hasn't Paul done his bit? And yet Paul knows that prison and hardships still await him. He's to endure a harrowing voyage and his fourth shipwreck. And yet through all this, God's power and salvation are revealed to the whole ship's company. Sometimes it takes a disaster to make us see it. In serving God like this, Paul brings glory to God and in turn is honoured as a man who changed world history. I preach this to myself. God doesn't guarantee an early or easy retirement for his people. Not in this life, anyway. And let's face it, most of us are unlikely to be in the position of Paul. But confessing and witnessing to Jesus might bring difficulty at work. It'll probably have social consequences. It might even make family life harder. It might lead to our being cancelled or cast out. If so, we can remember the joy that Jesus' people will have in him throughout. His peace, which passes all understanding. You might have made shipwreck of your own life. It happens. Maybe you've never known what plain sailing is. Perhaps life has been one long struggle. It all might seem almost pointless. But please don't conclude from your experience of this world that life is a meaningless, random process. All a matter of luck. Not going anywhere. With no purpose, just chance. Life with Jesus is never pointless. It's always going somewhere. It might involve storms and stormy journeys, but it always brings joy. The joy of knowing Jesus. The joy of a purpose-filled life with a glorious destination. How is this? Because of God's power in Jesus. Our second heading. We can trust God's power to fulfill his plans exactly. It saw Paul through all the trials and the opposition that the political and religious authorities and the mob could throw at him. It also saw Paul through the confrontation with nature we've just read about. It got the ship to Malta. Chance in a million from a human point of view for that ship. God's plan, among other things, was for Paul to go to Rome and witness to Jesus before the emperor. And we've seen this throughout the book of Acts. Most recently in 23, Paul was held in an army barracks and God said to him, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." And of course in verse 24 of our passage today, that glorious passage, we read how an angel of God told Paul, "You must stand before Caesar." So Paul stands as a picture of composure amidst chaos all around him. And he can do this because he knows God's plan. And he knows that God will execute that plan. And note verse 25.